each of these DOMs has the capacity to transmit at 2,047 volts. So to me, that makes this now the world's largest phased array transmitter. And I've started doing research and talking to folks. This is why I got in touch with Dr. Greer, because it's now matching into the science that he's presenting of directed energy weapons, earthquake generators, and the big one, I think, in regards to the secret space program specifically, is that this is the communications device for ships that can travel faster than the speed of light. First issue we would have when we send a ship away from the planet at great distance is, how do we now communicate with them? This is that device. It is for intergalactic communication.
You are listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Eric Hecker to Exopolitics Today, and he has a very interesting background and served for a year in Antarctica. So he's going to talk a little bit about his background, service in Antarctica, and fill us in on what he knows about some very interesting projects. So welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sala. I'm very happy to be here. I want to first say thanks for everything that you do for the community. It's been an inspiration for me. What you've done with Tony Rodriguez and everything has really helped me with where I've gone and what I've been deciphering. So thank you, and thanks for having me.
Well, first, I think I'd like to begin with your background. And you were born and raised in near the Montauk Point, which is where the infamous Montauk Project was staged on Long Island, New York. So why don't you tell us about your background and your kind of like any experiences you had while you were living there that might relate to the Montauk Project?
I grew up in an interesting community known as Levittown on Long Island, and it was built by William Levitt post-World War II for the veterans returning home. And it was, you know, kind of like almost low-income housing, like a benefit for them returning. And I would say it has a rich history in and of itself for all the programs that were probably happening to these veterans that didn't even know. I, myself, personally, was born in the 70s and found myself caught in what we now know as the Stargate program, which was a culmination of other programs like Grill Flame and Center Lane and other things that the CIA was working with, trying to figure out the science of consciousness, I guess you would say, was what they were trying to work with. And that was my childhood.
So with the Stargate project, I mean, what kind of association did you have with that? I mean, that began, I think it was around mid-1970s. So by 1994, that's kind of like 20 years after it began. Mm. So what was your association with that?
My association was in the early 80s, actually, when I was in grammar school. I would say probably, to the best of my recollection, would have started around 1980-81. Excuse me. And we would be pulled out of the classroom, brought to the library, and we were given eye drops. And the eye drops, from what my research is understanding, is some sort of a peculiar strain of LSD. And they would have us looking into these devices, some sort of training machine. And upon departing the library, I remembered there was an after effect that always stuck with my memory, was that there was a southern-facing lobby to my school, and the afternoon session, if I was debriefed fast enough, I'd have enough time after departing the library to have this eye drop have this yellow effect on my eyes. So everything was like as if I was seeing the world through yellow lenses. And it was something that I enjoyed as a kid. So it was something that always stuck in my head. But in the process of what was going on in the library, it was, you know, the term I had come across was a tachistoscope in one capacity, that they were trying to utilize some sort of peculiar training method. And there was also the idea that I recalled there was the way that you made decisions was very interesting to me. That always stuck into my head. I was very freaked out by this machine. It was very high tech at the time, early 1980s. And it would show you stuff and basically pose a question. And the way that you answered was by just looking at the answer. And the machine would know that that's what you selected. And I was so like, that blew my mind. I was like, this thing is like, how is it doing this? And I spent a lot of time in that process, really focusing on trying to figure out that machine. It always intrigued me.
That's very interesting. So you were identified in some way as one of these exceptionally talented kids, and you were brought into some special program where they did things to kind of test you. And now, do you remember ever being taken off site, off the school to do things? Do you remember kind of missing time?
Absolutely. We used to be brought, I was in a Catholic school, so we used to be removed from the school and taken on what we were told were retreats. And we were brought to a facility that I had have now since found has been knocked completely to the ground. But it was this ancient, massive mansion that at the time that it was constructed on Long Island was the fourth largest home in the country. The family that built it was very tightly associated with the Jesuits. And we were being bussed over to this facility for what we were told was a religious retreat, but instead a certain amount of us would get peeled off from the larger community of kids being shuttled in there. And we'd get brought in to do what I now know to be SRA type stuff, which is, you know, unfortunate, but that stuff happens in the world as well. And people need to know about it so we can stop it.
Of course. So you you were what, about 7 years old, 8 years old when this began?
I would say approximately that and potentially younger. I would say from pretty much kindergarten, first grade era onward.
And how long did that go for? I mean, how long do you have these memories of being in these kinds of special classes or being taken off school campus?
I would say that definitively would have stretched right up to eighth grade for sure. In that program where I would say that I would recognize all the cues, you know, and then I switched from eighth grade, then I went to a completely different school in ninth grade. So I don't believe that I would have been out from under the thumb of whatever guiding program I was involved with. I just think it might have shifted gears in a way that I was no longer seeing the same cues.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever come across any kind of name for this project that you were part of?
I recall it being, and it goes both ways in my head, but the TAG or the GATE program seems to ring a bell. I do remember them talking us up, like boosting our egos. Like when we got pulled out of class to go to the library, like they were really like, you know, enforcing that we were special, that we're super smart, that we're above, you know, and they were really inculcating that thought in us.
Mm-hmm. And what was it about you in terms of your skills, your abilities that you think that they were most interested in?
In hindsight, what I understand us to have been accomplishing was we were actively remote viewing for them while they were not telling us that's what we were doing. So it was very weird to me to be in the library at my school. I used to think of it like Bizarro World, like growing up as a kid. We had Superman and then there was Bizarro, which was like the weird Superman where everything's backwards and odd. So I thought of it like Bizarro World in the library. You know, I grew up in a very regimented German, Irish, Catholic background where, you know, there's a right and there's a wrong and there's a line and you either cross it or you don't. But when we got to the library, it was like everything that we previously taught was thrown out the window. You know, now they can ask you questions and anything's the right answer. It doesn't matter. And it just tell us whatever you think. It's the right answer. And I was like, what are you talking about, lady? You know, this is all nonsense. So it seemed like a joke. Like it seemed like, why are all the adults in here being crazy right now? But I'll play along. Oh, you want me to tell you what I see right now? Okay, I see a mountain. Okay, I do see a lake, you know, and we would go through the motions of what I now know to be the very regimented process of remote viewing. They just weren't telling me then.
Now, can you remember any kind of targets? Does anything stand out, and in particular, anything related to, say, extraterrestrials?
I don't actually. I don't remember a lot of the stuff we were doing, because it was like they were just asking me to basically spill the beans. I do remember that it was a lot of the and now the terms I'm not getting it, but where you would draw the line randomly. And then they would ask you the questions about the line. And it was just more of the processes coming back to me. That's what really struck a chord, was when I started looking into it. I was like, oh my God, I'm like, this is exactly what we were doing. But they certainly weren't, they weren't filling me in on it. And additionally, I think what a lot of people don't actually understand about remote viewing as a tool is that I was a tool in a toolkit. So I probably had a specialty that they weren't talking to me about. So if they want to remote view a target, like lots of times they might take 6 or 12 viewers, and they might have one that's good at colors. They might have one that's good at scents. They might have one that's good at visuals. They might have one that's good at math, like whatever faculties they're looking for, they'll put tools in the toolkit. There's very few and far between viewers that are up at the level of like Ingo Swann or something like that, that can, you know, almost be magical in their ways. But it doesn't mean that the CIA wasn't trying to figure out how to wield these new powers that they were learning were legitimate.
Do you remember any of those? Do you know? I mean, there are like Hal Puthoff that are associated with the founding of remote viewing. Do you remember any kind of people that are famous in terms of remote viewing that were involved in this program?
I can say that I have a familiarity to folks, but I couldn't say that I know.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Targ looks oddly familiar to me.
Okay. Do you?
And he seems to be somebody that's around these programs. And there's just certain folks that seem to be in such proximity that I'm definitively keeping my eye on. And a lot of the stuff that I'm figuring out when I'm, you know, deciphering my past, you know, the guiding light is pretty much my soul and my feeling on things first. And then that puts me in a direction to start looking at things, and I dig, and I'm finding things to be true. I'm finding there are facts available that, you know, there's obviously somebody's doing these things to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very significant. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with Tony Rodriguez's story concerning Russell Targ. Do you know that, where he says that, I think it was in 1984, where he actually was taken to China Lake, and he says that Russell Targ was one of the remote viewing instructors there. So very interesting that you mentioned Russell Targ.
That is rather interesting.
Did you know that?
I didn't know that he had said that. I'm halfway through his book right now. So I was hoping to find something to, you know, I'm always looking for connections, but I hadn't known that specifically.
It's very interesting because you're saying you recall memories of being a child, you know, in the 80s, Russell Targ being someone that may have been involved. I mean, you're not certain of that, but the names.
His name and his image keeps showing up, like in my research. Okay. And it's one of those things that it's like every time it pops up, I just get this, like, you know, like there's a feeling. There's a feeling, mm-hmm. and I don't like it. It's a negative feeling.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So we're not certain about his involvement, but certainly it's very interesting that matches mm-hmm. what Tony Rodriguez had to say. Now, you briefly mentioned it. Now, how was the SRA involved in this training as a child
for you? I can only assume that they say that it's utilized to invoke a dissociative identity syndrome in folks, is I believe that's what they're trying to function, is that they were working on this greater understanding of consciousness And I believe it was Itzhak Bentov's book, Stalking the Wild Pendulum on the Mechanics of Consciousness, along with the information from the Monroe Institute that the CIA had subcontracted. And this was the basis of what they were trying to do. And somehow, somewhere, somebody decided that SRA would be utilized to, cause dissociation so that these new modalities of understanding of consciousness could be applied to, basically rape the mentality as well of these children to be used for compartmentalization programs in the future.
Now, of course, this happened in the 1980s, and since that time, in terms of your life, do you remember any incidents or have any experiences which might suggest that you were put through this SRA and this kind of dissociation was created and you had an altar created where that could be triggered sometime in some way?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And these recollections are few and far between because they're harsh. I have done regressions in things like that. So I have worked with Mary Rodwell, and I've done some stuff with other folks locally, and I've gone in these directions, but my higher self has said that I don't really need to go back that far. So I have an understanding of what was going on in these places, and I have flashes of things. And the retreats were basically, I have recollections that the group that I would be with would be brought to meet other groups of the group of boys that I was with would be brought to meet groups of girls from other schools. And we were basically being set up to perform publicly for groups of adults. So that was one aspect of things going on that I have recollections of.
Okay,
go ahead.
Tony Rodriguez also talked about as a child being sold into or being used in one of these programs and having being told to entertain adults, and that was SRA was involved, and this would happen late at night. So, mm-hmm. so you recall
that? I am aware that he did say that stuff for sure.
Mm-hmm. And you have some matching experiences or memories?
I can remember in my head where I was and where it happened at, but it sounds pretty much the same to me.
Yeah, it does. So a lot of similarities there with a lot of what other secret space program insiders have said in terms of like being identified early, being put through some kind of training program where their skills were identified and enhanced. So obviously in your case, psychic abilities, remote viewing, that was among whatever skill sets you had that were of use to these programs. And then the typical trajectory is that, by the time these insiders get to the age of 16, 17, 18, they get recruited into the secret space programs. Now, you actually have record of joining the U.S. Navy in 1994. So what, you were 18 or 19, something like that, fresh out of high school, and you joined the U.S. Navy, and you were with them for 9 months. So why don't you tell us what happened?
It was a very interesting time in my life, for sure. It was a crash course in the military, going to boot camp, going to basic enlisted submarine school. And I was doing quite well. But then, when I got there, things were odd. And I was, always observant. I was obviously, an astute student and could figure things out. And I started to, have a lot of questions in the submarine service, I would just say. And it was getting a bit more complex for me than other sailors who ask less questions, I imagine. And I'll just say that it's tough for me to talk about a lot of the things with the submarine service, but I know there's things to discuss. And I'll just say that in the process, of me getting disconnected from the United States Submarine Service. There was a time at the New London train station where I was met by a person who presented themselves as the executive officer of the USS Groton. And this person most certainly was not the executive officer. If anybody knows anything about the United States Submarine Service, you will know that they have an absurdly young crew, including command staff. This gentleman was old. He was completely white hair and obviously not on a sub crew. But I just listened and I figured I'll hear what he has to say. He was inquiring to me about, how is your training going? How's everything doing? You know, what are you up to? And, oh, that's great. And, you know, we had also been trained, a bit of counter-espionage. They told us that we were going to be involved with things that people are going to try to get info from this department. So they had, always told us to be on guard. So I had figured this is just, I stepped into it and this guy is digging for info and God only knows what faction he represents. So he started asking me stuff about the nuclear capacities and the weapons. And I know these questions are off limits. So now I know I'm in the red zone. He offers to buy me a drink. I was underage. I informed him that I was underage. I said that, you're going to get you and I in trouble. And he assured me that this isn't a problem. He purchased a beer for both of us. I started drinking. I was totally crossing a line at the time, but thinking to myself, I'm apparently crossing lines here. We're just going to see how far this goes. Long story short of him engaging me, I said, I have to get back to the train station. We get into the cab. I definitively looked at my watch because I wanted to see if we were going to make it back to the train in time. I was not paying attention to the specificity of the time just as much as I was going to make it. I wish I remembered the time. But I did know that it was a 5-minute train ride, basically, and it took us 25 minutes. I lost 20 minutes there. When I opened up that door and I was being released out of that taxi, I had lost 20 minutes with that guy in the back of that cab.
Typically, what I have heard from insiders who have gone through the recruitment process is that they describe a period where they get offered this opportunity to serve the Navy mm-hmm. or to serve America in a special way. Mm-hmm. And they're asked, well, do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. And the recruit says, well, yes. Mm-hmm. And then after that, something happens and mm-hmm. it can be a very anomalous thing like what you just described where, there's missing times, there's kind of like hazy memories, but something very, very strange. But as these people come back later or as these people recall in subsequent years is that they actually were taken into one of these programs and after a period of service, then brought back. Mm-hmm. And that accounts for the kind of hazy memories and the missing time. So mm-hmm. it sounds like you're meeting with this elderly gentleman. I guess he was wearing the uniform of an executive officer, claiming to be, but he made that claim.
He made the claim. He was just simply in civilian clothing.
Okay. Very interesting. So, yep. It could be that, or maybe there was something else, but
there actually is, now that you mention it, there is more to this because like I had said earlier, I was basically trying to figure a way out at the time already when this occurred. And in that process, there was another sailor that I knew from the smoke pit who was getting discharged. I don't know why, but he was always very nervous in the smoke pit. And he knew that I was trying to get out. And he told me he knew a guy. And I met his guy in the bottom. I know the building, but I'm not going to name the number. I met him in the bottom of a building that I was getting trained in. I had access to this building at the time. I was directed to go meet this guy in his lab, his office, in the bottom of this top secret clearance building. This was a Raytheon employee. And this is where I learned about Raytheon. And I recall going to meet this gentleman, and it was through assisting him with his project that he said that he was going to help me get out of the Navy.
That's very interesting. So there does seem to have been this opportunity for you to have been part of a highly classified program, possibly the secret space program, could be anything else, but it may be that person associated with Raytheon and going into a classified facility. That's interesting because Raytheon is one of the companies, we'll talk about them a little later, that has a history of being involved in the secret space programs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One of the interesting things that has also been raised is that typically people who serve in the secret space programs, they're discouraged from either from completing their military service. Randy Kramer is a good example of this. He says that he was recruited into the secret space program run by the U.S. Marine Corps. I don't know if you know, have heard of Randy Kramer, but he says that he was recruited into that, and that afterwards he was told not to join them, or he was kind of pressured not to join any military service, but he went ahead and joined the Navy, but then things happened, and so he had to kind of like get out. So yeah, in his memory, he had the recollection that after completing his service, or after completing his secret space program service, he was discouraged from joining or being part of any military program.
Mm-hmm. I had not heard that aspect before. I'm absolutely aware of who Randy Kramer is, but I had never heard anybody say that before. That's very interesting. I feel that shoe fits.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. Other people have had very different experiences, but certainly in your case, I mean, 9 months, I mean, we're talking the normal term of enlistment is what, 3 years, 4 years with the
US submarine? My contract service was for six.
Six. Okay. So something extraordinary must have happened for you to kind of like leave early.
I actually do believe something extraordinary must have happened in 1994, and I'm trying to figure it out. Dang it.
Okay, so you're saying you're not quite sure why it was that you had to leave the Navy in 1994 after having served only, I mean, you did boot camp, and then you served, what, an additional 9 months, or was it like?
It was a total of nine. So it was boot camp is only, you know, weeks. And then I did basic enlisted submarine school. So the interesting thing is I did really well in boot camp. I did really well in basic enlisted submarine school. Like, you know, so I guess in a way, if these programs are looking for folks, like I was like hitting all the check marks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that at some point I just got, you know, they veered me off the standard line of folks and probably processed me into another program. And I'm, I guess, coming and going in ways that are more familiar to other people than me, but I'm trying to figure it out. I do recall that there was a massive, massive verbal argument about my departure from the Navy, that there were folks that there was a room full of high-ranking people. I was outside basically at parade rest in the hallway, and there was a room full of high-ranking people that wanted me basically to go to Leavenworth for some reason. So everyone was very mad in that room, except for one person who I have no idea who this person was, but he was apparently my representative in that room. And I remember very clearly that the crowd was angry and said that they had some god-awful crazy fortune. I feel weird saying it, but it sounded like tens of millions of dollars they were talking about being invested in me, and that he's not just like walking away. And the guy that was representing me was expressing with great vigor that I had free will and that there was nothing they could do about it. And that was the conversation. And that was my departure from the Navy, is that that guy, whoever that guy was in there, he brokered the deal and I was released from service.
Well, that's very interesting because, I mean, you only served for 9 months. Now, that's certainly nowhere near millions of dollars of investment in you, unless
I agree.
Unless
it's
there
weird
was,
to me.
Yeah, there must have been a long history, but presumably you may have done something like some classified, you were part of some classified program where essentially millions of dollars of training was invested, which suggests many years. I mean, millions of dollars, I mean, we're talking many years or even decades of investment by the Navy. I mean, that's very unusual that there were officers at that meeting wanting to send you to Fort Leavenworth because somehow you leaving meant that the Navy was losing millions of dollars that it had invested in you. That could only happen if you had been part of an extended classified program.
I do believe that I have that in my history as well, as you know, that a lot of these things are bloodlines, that this is generational. And I can follow this through my history of my family. There are connections to the OSS and my family on Long Island and the greater metropolitan New York area, which is, I think, what probably got me tangled up in the Montauk Project type stuff. There's a lot that was going on the east end of Long Island post-World War II with the Nazis. And it seems that my grandfather was involved with what was known as the American Bund, which was a faction here that was, you know, working with the OSS folks that were being brought over post-Nuremberg trials. As a child, I would go up to the Catskills, and there was a gentleman who was previously in the SS, but now he was somebody that, as a child, I would shoot pool with. So there's a lot to be said for things and how long I've been associated to stuff because of my family's, I guess, association to programs that came from Germany all the way over to here.
Mm-hmm. So at this stage, I mean, you don't have any memories of what you may have done or what you were involved in, or do you?
I'm trying to figure those out because that's extremely challenging. I try to be very logical. That's how I was reared. That's how my reasoning works and how I understand things. I have a brain full of memories of things that sound like SSP missions and the such, but it's hard for me to make that leap. I mean, I'm very real world and I'm trying to prove things with facts. I do believe everybody's testimony has value. And I guess I'm trying to get comfortable myself with, I guess, stating that, you know, I think I'm a time traveling spaceman.
Okay. So you do have memories then of some kind of SSP involvement, which is consistent with what you've described to me. And of course, this is documentable. I mean, you actually have your DD-214 that confirms that you did serve with the Navy. So that's very interesting. So now we kind of like fast forward. And in October of 2010, you took a job in Antarctica. So this was a position that was advertised by, of all companies, Raytheon. So that's very interesting. So why don't you explain what happened?
You got it. I was I had my own company on Long Island. I did plumbing and heating service. I was available 24 hours a day. And then the economy tanked really badly. And I wasn't a businessman. I was a tradesman. So I didn't know what to do. I just started looking for work. And there wasn't work anywhere in the entire country. I found two jobs. One of them was listed for Centennial, Colorado. I applied. And they said, guess what? It's not really for here. It's for Antarctica. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that. So I applied to a job at McMurdo and I applied to a job at South Pole Station. It actually took me, I think, 2 seasons, 2 years basically of applying before I got contacted. And then they said, you know, hey, you applied for a plumber, all these different things and all these different seasons, but we're really looking for someone that can do an entire year at the South Pole Station. Would you be willing to do that? And I said that I would, because at the time it was the only people willing to cut me a check. And it was Raytheon Polar Services. So I was familiar with Raytheon from my previous run-in, and I was anxious to say the least about this whole thing. So I went that way anyhow, and I got myself to South Pole.
That is fascinating that you actually got to serve for a whole year at the South Pole Station, Scott Amundsen Station there. So your primary responsibility was to do maintenance on something called the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector. So do you want to explain what that is?
No problem at all. And I'll just say that was actually just one of many things that I did there. My primary mission was to fix everything. But the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector was certainly on my to-do list every single day. That facility had to be checked. The reason being, oddly enough, is that the amount of computer server towers and processing going on in that building was so extreme, the amount of heat being generated, the thermostat functioned a louver that would open up and bring the exterior air in. So that computer lab needed to be chilled by the winter temperatures of the South Pole. That's how much power was going through it. And that was by one of the things I had to do was go out there, and there was an air inlet on the exterior that had chicken wire all over it. And the chicken wire would simply get filled up with the snow and block it. So I'd have to go out there every single day, knock the snow off. Or if I was lucky enough to catch one of the ice cubers, the scientists that were running it, there was two of them there for that winter season, Freya and Jens. If they happened to be going that way, they would be more than happy to do it for me. And we would just communicate those things. There was also an Italian scientist named Marco, who was an avid cross-country skier. And he was oftentimes let me know if he was going that way, and he would do it for me as well. But the detector itself, as defined by the structures, they say it's a detector for neutrinos, and the reaction is at the nucleus level of the water molecules in the ice, which is 2 miles high at the South Pole Station. They drill down with steam, and they put these cables down in the holes that they make with the steam. On the cable, they have all these different DOMs. They're about the size of a basketball. They're like a clear acrylic, so light can pass through them. And they're, I guess you'd say, photosensitive. And they're strung about throughout the ice in basically a large hexagram shape. And there's 5,160 of these DOMs embedded in the ice, with the idea being that when a neutrino comes in from any direction, doesn't matter whether it's off planet, through the planet, the detector and the neutrinos don't really care. So when they come through in any direction and make contact with the nucleus of a water molecule, the reaction occurs that creates a blue flash of light, which I believe is called the Cherenkov radiation. I'm saying it probably incorrectly. And then also a muon is ejected when the blue flash occurs. The blue flash is what the DOMs are trying to detect. And when they get a bloom, basically, of all the detectors going off, then they can understand from which direction the neutrino came from. And then they communicate that information, and all these other different pieces of equipment on the planet are then aligned to try to understand where the neutrino came from. And that's what we're presented is going on at the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector.
With the neutrinos, these are part of the cosmic rays that are our solar system. So ostensibly they want to measure these to test scientific hypotheses. And the South Pole is the location for the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector because that's where the Earth's magnetosphere follows its natural magnetic converge at the north and south pole, which means that cosmic rays coming in are kind of like more easily measured as they approach the Earth and get into the Earth. So, yeah, do you want to explain a little bit more clearly why it is that the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector was placed there at the South Pole?
Absolutely. It has everything to do with the clarity of the ice, the purity of the ice. That's what they're looking for, is that neutrino contact with the nucleus of the water. So it's the pure ice that made that device be constructed there as a receiver.
So this is a massive facility. You mentioned 5,100 of these digital optical modules, DOMs, and they're spread out over what, 4 square miles and 2 miles deep. So
more
so
or less. That? Yeah, so more or less. It's massive. It is what I believe is probably the world's largest phased array transmitter, actually, because I know it transmits as well.
Yeah, that's a really big statement right there. So why don't you just explain the difference between a receiver and a transmitter when it comes to this neutrino?
Sure. Well, I guess I'll start with I did provide documentation, so it is available. I have a website, deciphering.tv, and there's archive section. You can find the DOM document. So the facts are the facts. Each of these DOMs has the capacity to transmit at 2,047 volts. So to me, that makes this now the world's largest phased array transmitter. And I've started doing research and talking to folks. This is why I got in touch with Dr. Greer, because it's now matching into the science that he's presenting of directed energy weapons, earthquake generators, and the big one, I think, in regards to the secret space program specifically, is that this is the communications device for ships that can travel faster than the speed of light. The first issue we would have when we send a ship away from the planet at great distance is, how do we now communicate with them? This is that device. It is for intergalactic communication.
Well, this is going to be a very interesting kind of topic, because in terms of detecting or receiving, I mean, the neutrino detector obviously detects neutrinos interacting with the ice and measures these for scientific experiments. But as a transmitter, it can transmit enormous amounts of electromagnetic energy. And so, you know, that can be used as a directed energy weapon. And that in itself is fascinating and can be used for multiple purposes. But this that I hadn't heard. I mean, a communication. Now, I know that electromagnetic communication is efficient for kind of long distance communication in spacecraft, because obviously talking about something, spacecraft traveling in the far reaches of our system, it would take, you know, hours to get from, say, Pluto to the Earth using electromagnetic communications. But quantum communications is a different thing. It's instantaneous. So are you saying that the neutrino detector could be used as a communications device for quantum, or is it more electromagnetic?
I believe it's on the more quantum side, sir. And I have documentation in my archive section for that as well. I'm a much better student than a teacher. So I've taken a great example of some work that other folks have provided on how this works. And I've put it in the archive section just to show that this is what I'm finding to be at the South Pole Station. You know, folks say that if this was going on, somebody would say something. Well, you know what? I'm that somebody. It is going on. I was there, and I'm just trying to let folks know. And there is a path to figuring out the facts. And I'm just putting forth documentation that is supporting the concerns that other people have already addressed.
Mm-hmm. So while you were working on the neutrino detector at the South Pole, you know, what was it that convinced you that this is more than just the receiver, that it's an actual transmitter of very powerful, high voltage energies?
I would say that at the time, sir, I was trying to lay low for Raytheon. I was trying to be an observer and a sponge entirely. And I do not think that I had come anywhere near that level of understanding of the facility that I was in. I certainly believe that there's something else going on, because Raytheon was involved and the remoteness of everything and what I know about, you know, clandestine stuff from the submarine service. So I knew to pay attention. But boy, I did not figure out for quite some time what they were up to, because how would have I, man, the way they compartmentalize stuff, it would have been hard pressed. But I did realize that just from what I knew as a tradesman, I knew the expense of this structure that I was being told was, it just seemed extremely exorbitant, even in these types of programs. I think the price tag was like in the like hundreds of billions of dollars or something to construct this thing. And the cabling, I guess, was an indicator to me at the time that I knew it was a lie. Like, so I didn't come across the documentation until many years later that proved my own suspicion that this thing seemed to have the ability to move a lot more power than needed. Like, I saw that myself. I mean, there's all kinds of pictures. You could anybody can look at the construction photos. They're online. This is, you know, open to the public. And you can look at the size of the cables and stuff that they're pulling. This is, you know, odd. I saw it myself firsthand. And now I've provided documentation that explains why they're moving a lot of power. They transmit.
Mm-hmm. That's a critical thing, because they're not going to need so much power if it's just a receiver detecting neutrinos that are coming in for what kind of experiments they're doing on cosmic ray activity and measuring the strength or the weakness of the Earth's magnetosphere. So the ice cube detector is actually also a transmitter, and it can send enormous amounts of electromagnetic energy into the upper atmosphere, into space. Now, you also mentioned that you thought that the ice cube detector could be used for a voice-to-skull transmission. So can you explain that?
I believe that this device is so powerful and multifaceted that I can't imagine that it doesn't have the ability to do influencing of folks in their heads mentally, that this technology is available. They've been using it at the very least since Desert Storm that we're familiar with. And I think this would just put it on another level. This is just like, it's basically like a big HARP system on steroids. Mm-hmm. So I get concerned with the oddity of, you know, I don't need to be specific, but in the last few years, let's just say, I believe there's a high potential that people were a little bit out of their minds, and it might've been induced. Mm-hmm. That people were just suggested things the last few years to acquiesce and go along. That suggestion could be applied.
It's very good that you mentioned the HARP system in Alaska, because, you know, people are very familiar or somewhat familiar with the HARP system. I think that was the very first kind of phased array antenna system that was considered to be used as a potential ionosphere heater. Now, of course, it was spread out over a certain kind of like acreage. I don't remember exactly whether it was a square mile or how much acreage it actually took up, but it was considered quite a big ionospheric heater and powerful transmitter of ELF waves that could achieve things. Now, the thing to keep in mind for all the listeners here is that HARP facility in Alaska is pretty much like a two-dimensional array system. It's on the surface. Whereas the ice cube is actually not just on the surface, it extends 2 miles down. So you're not just talking about like a 1 square kilometer or a 1 square mile phased array system. You're talking about an 8 cubic mile phased array system in the South Pole. So you want to just kind of like elaborate and kind of fill in why potentially the ice cube system is much more powerful as a transmitter?
I think you nailed it right there. Just on size alone, we're talking it's exponentially bigger than the system in Alaska. And I've gone up to the front gates of that facility in Gokona, Alaska twice. So I'm doing due diligence to see what I can see wherever I can find it and motor to. And there's definitely, you know, there's oddity up there as well. But the Ice Cube facility is enormous. It's so much bigger. And I do believe that there has to be some value to, like, even though it's not its purpose to be there for the passive aspect of the neutrinos with the, like you had said earlier, the geomagnetic aspect of the Southern Pole. I believe on its transmitting side, that location matters. So that being at the southern pole of the planet and using the ice cube facility on its transmit side, I think is something we all need to start asking serious questions about what that can do on and off this planet. I'm just starting this conversation. I do not have all of the answers. I'm just trying to present to the world that there's basically a new gun to your head that you didn't know about. And we should all figure this out fast.
Yes, it definitely is a new gun. I mean, as you just confirmed, I mean, it's much bigger and more powerful than the HAARP facility in Alaska. Now, the Ice Cube facility actually went online, I think it was September 2010. Or sometime around that period, and maybe you can fill us in.
But oh, geez. It was our summer season, and I think it would have been towards the tail end of the summer season because they would have had to complete construction. That would be my best guesstimate off the top of my head. It would have been the summer of 2010 going into the winter of 2011 that the Ice Cube neutrino detector and the Adamson Scott elevated station both went from construction to operations and maintenance.
Mm-hmm. And the significance of that is that in September of 2010 and February of 2011, there were these massive earthquakes in Christchurch, New Zealand. And, mm-hmm. and you believe that this is related to Ice Cube activation. So you want to elaborate?
Absolutely, sir. And that's great question, and I want people to hear this loud and clear. I've spoken to people from the crew on the startup side. They said it was an accident. They didn't mean it, but they were turning it on. And just like any other thing, you have to calibrate and dial it in. And they were doing things for the first time. And the first couple of efforts, it was New Zealand that suffered.
So when you say you were speaking to the crew and they said that they were just dialing things up and they more or less confirmed that there was something involved with the activation of Ice Cube with those earthquakes in Christchurch, New Zealand. So right there, you've got confirmation that the Ice Cube receptor is not just a receiver, but it's actually a transmitter.
Correct, sir. And it concerns me because I feel I very much understand the threat, and I'm just trying to convey this to everybody else, is that we have fair questions of what things have been funded on this planet and what they do.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that the Ice Cube neutrino detector has been used for weather warfare?
Absolutely, 100%. I believe that my crew, because of compartmentalization, the vast majority of us, myself included at the time, had no idea what we were operating and maintaining. But since that system being what it is, both a passive listening device and a covert weapon of modern warfare, I don't think that whoever our enemies were, I think knew exactly who we were. And I believe that we were engaged in modern subterfuge warfare, and parts of my crew were negatively impacted by what the news is now calling Havana syndrome. So there's going to be a new walking wounded on this planet that people aren't prepared for. And the Havana syndrome symptom list is basically the bullet holes of directed energy weapons. These are the new guns, and Havana syndrome is the list of bullet holes that we get. I'm learning about it because I know parts of my crew were impacted, and I didn't know who to go to or what to talk about that, because boy, that would have sounded crazy 10 years ago. But I've had conversations, and I know about a half a dozen people from my crew that are also suffering Havana syndrome-like symptoms, myself included. So I believe that at the South Pole Station, we were also attacked by directed energy weapons, or we suffered damage from being in proximity to these weapons when they were being used offensively.
This weather modification or weather warfare application that may be part of one of the functions of the ice cube detector there in the South Pole is very interesting, because in 2017, I was involved in a case involving an insider sharing photographs of anti-gravity spacecraft that were photographed near MacDill Air Force Base, home of Special Operations Command, there in Tampa, Florida. And so he was releasing this, and he was being told to release them by covert operatives who were actually guiding him to release these photos of these flying triangles, flying rectangles. And they're on my website. The insider, his name is JP. So he was sharing all these photos with me. And then lo and behold, this enormous hurricane makes a beeline for Tampa, Florida. And for the first time in its history, MacDill Air Force Base had to shut down. So, you know, I actually asked around and did research. And so I thought that Hurricane Irma may, and there were a number of people saying that Hurricane Irma was actually a result of weather modification. But one of the things I remember in doing due diligence on Hurricane Irma, and I think there's a weather modification researcher, Dane Wigginton, who did a lot of work to specify how Hurricane Irma was directed by energy weapons. But one of the things that I encountered when doing the due diligence is that people observed these enormous electromagnetic energies coming out of Antarctica. So my question is, do you think it's possible that Hurricane Irma in September 2017 could have been caused or influenced in some way by this ice cube neutrino detector?
I think 1,000%. 1,000%, I believe it's possible. I think that's exactly the problem with this facility, is that I think I found it. I believe I've seen folks that show these energy beams and stuff with whatever type of, you know, spectrogram thing that they're showing, you know, of the planet and, you know, the atmosphere and these different waves going through it. They are coming right out of Antarctica. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, I believe this is, you know, I caught them red-handed. Thanks, Raytheon.
Yeah, that's very important, because I think, you know, the placement of that neutrino detector right there at the South Pole, right where all of the magnetic line field lines of the Earth converge, would make it a really handy location to be able to send electromagnetic pulses into the upper atmosphere to cause weather modification and steer weather patterns wherever you want. So, So maybe the Alaska array was kind of like an early test. The HAARP facility was an early test, and what we see there at the South Pole was really the more advanced version of a phased array electromagnetic generating system that could be used for weather modification.
I agree, and I would add to that that as each of these facilities is wildly multifaceted in and of itself, we can't forget that now combining these devices, making this device a component and another device a component to another activity across the planet, also has value that people aren't really putting their brains in that direction to consider, is that things get more complex. So now, let's just say, you know, the HAARP facility existed in Alaska and was its own demon. Now we have this beast at the South Pole station. Yes, independently, they're their own monsters, but boy, oh boy, what happens when these two things work together? What can they accomplish? And what other things have we yet to know can be accomplished in this reality? As we're so distracted by what's being thrown on the propaganda machine every night of television, you know, and social media, they're doing well to attempt to divide us from any beneficial future for everybody.
Yes, very important that we look at exactly what that facility is being used for and how it might be related to what is happening around the world right now. So before we move on, is there anything else you want to kind of like say about the neutrino detector?
I think that probably about covers it for the detector, sir. I think I hope that everybody understands how real of a potential threat this is. I mean, yes, it's great. There's benefits. I love that we can communicate with the folks out in the secret space program. I think that's fantastic. But there's some nefarious things that could be going on with it as well, that I think we should look into.
Yeah. And I think it's worth just emphasizing that the South Pole location is unique on Earth because there's nowhere else. I mean, the North Pole, North Pole, you don't actually have anything at the North Pole where you could build this kind of massive phased array detector system, you know, into 2 miles of ice. I think the North Pole, I mean, the ice sheets melt during the summer now because, you know, so-called global warming. So South Pole is unique.
Very unique, sir.
So I want to now ask you about this very curious case from that was reported by a U.S. Navy flight engineer. His name was Brian. I actually got to meet him at one of these Contact in the Desert conferences, but he first was interviewed by Linda Moulton Howe, and he said that when he was flying, he was a flight engineer for the US Navy. And during the 1985-1986 summer season, he said he was flying a medevac mission, and he flew over the South Pole. And he did it because they had been given instructions to avoid an area 5 miles from the South Pole, from the Munson Scott base, to avoid that area in terms of overflight. But because it was an emergency, they directly flew over it. And he says that he saw this massive hole or tunnel going from the surface into the ice, going deep down. And he said it was massive. It was big enough for a C-130 cargo plane and was 5 miles from the South Pole station. So, you know, this occurred in 85-86, and of course you were there in 2010, so we're talking 25 year difference. So I mean, my question is, have you heard or did you see anything that suggests that there is this massive entrance on or somewhere close to the South Pole station to the Earth?
I have heard a fistful of folks make a claim similar to that one. I have never seen anybody produce a photo from a camera that every person on the ice has on them. So I just find it interesting. I hope someday that someone takes a picture. I don't know what the holdup is.
Right, but you've heard from people now. Are you talking about people who actually were working at South Pole, that they had heard of a hole like this?
No, this is stuff that I've heard off the ice. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that people are misinterpreting the blueprint, the map, basically. At the South Pole station, there's what's referred to as the Arrow Building, the Atmospheric Research Observatory. It is a clean air testing facility. So when people look on the map and they see what they're referring to as a no-fly zone is a airspace that comes with restrictions. It doesn't mean you can't fly there. It is a ceiling height. They don't want you flying too low in a certain zone that they mark off and they show here. Oh, this is the area. Please don't fly here. But when you look, like when pilots have a flight plan, there's details. So they'll look into, oh, what is this no-fly zone? And they look at the details, and what it states is, hey, when you're coming into the airway at the South Pole station, they're just giving directions. Hey, we need you to come around this way, A, because that's the direction you come in for landing. And they're giving you guidance to steer clear of the Atmospheric Research Observatory and stay above a certain height. So first and foremost, it's not even a restriction of an area that you can't go over, because you're allowed to go over it. You just can't go too low, because then your exhaust from the flight will trip the sensors of the clean air systems that they're trying to test for clean air. So with that being said, you can imagine this flight being unobstructed, so to say. And since the South Pole station is at 10,300 feet of actual elevation with not a mountain range or obstruction anywhere to be found. I find it next to impossible for anybody to be flying within 50 miles of the South Pole in any capacity and not see whatever this hole is. And of all the people that have been in the program through all of the years and all of the amazing cameras that make it onto the continent, and all of the no restrictions against photographs. There's a lot of people in this program, I think, would have a photograph and a video of a hole. Mm-hmm. I certainly took pictures and video of everything I could find. So I get everybody else's perspective may be different than mine. But from my perspective, as somebody who spent a year at the South Pole Station, effectively making it my home, my family, when I hear other people discussing my home and my family, it just, you know, seems weird to me mm-hmm. when it doesn't match my version.
Right. Okay. All right. So you sound a little skeptical that such a hole could exist, but we are talking 25 years after Brian said mm-hmm. that he saw this. So
right. I am not opposed to the concept. I believe Admiral Byrd wrote about this, and I trust Byrd, and I believe that he got classified, and because he was discussing real things. So I'm not opposed to this stuff, but I'm also familiar with factions like COINTELPRO mm-hmm. and limited hangouts and disinformation and leading people down the wrong paths. And all I know is that I'm no expert at this. I just proceed with caution.
One of the things that was very puzzling from this was August of 2015 was that the ice cube detector detected neutrinos coming from inside the Earth. Now, it was designed to detect cosmic rays, and this was part of the scientific experiments to understand the behavior of cosmic rays and whether how much the magnetosphere is deflecting and absorbing and so forth. But they didn't anticipate neutrinos coming from inside the Earth. So how could that happen?
I remember that article, and to the best of my recollection, I felt like that was once again the general population of the planet being presented someone's misinterpretation of what's going on down there. The detector absolutely is designed to detect neutrinos coming from any direction from it, which absolutely includes neutrinos that will come from through the Earth. Neutrinos are coming through all of us from every direction constantly, and they're just so small that they happen to pass through the nucleus and electron shell of every atom. And it's happening, it's omnipresent in every direction, and the detector will function that way from every direction. And it seemed like the writers of those articles were just not understanding the science they were discussing.
Well, as I understand it, neutrinos can pass through the Earth to the extent that they don't hit or are absorbed by molecules. That once they hit a molecule, they can be absorbed by it.
So a reaction could totally occur if there's a contact, but they're so small that it makes a contact very rare. And that's, again, why they chose the ice at the South Pole, because of its density and clarity. Mm-hmm. That it's one of the rare places that makes it challenging in nature to have a neutrino contact.
Okay. Well, I just want to throw out an explanation and to get your reaction to it. And this is something that I've come across recently in there have been a number of sources that have described this, but one of the more compelling is it comes from a book describing inner Earth civilizations that are made possible because in the center of the Earth doesn't have a kind of like an iron core, which mainstream scientists believe, based on seismic activities and radar, that actually the center of the Earth has a singularity point. And that singularity point essentially forms a black hole in the center of the Earth, and around it is the sun, kind of like as a black hole. It absorbs light and absorbs activities, but also transmits things as well. But there's a sun inside of the Earth. And so just as our sun transmits neutrinos and as the galactic core transmits neutrinos, so too this kind of black sun, if you like, or this singularity point in the center of the Earth transmits neutrinos. So I just wanted to get your reaction to that possible explanation for why it was in 2015 Ice Cube was detecting neutrino coming from within the Earth.
I think that would be really cool. Yeah, I mean, that would be fantastic. My mind is 100% open to all possibility exists always. I think there's a lot of stuff going on that we haven't been told. I'm game. If we can start going in a direction that proves that, and we can start practically applying that information, I'm there.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last question is, in April of this year, it was in March of this year, over East Antarctica, there were temperatures, and it seemed to be this massive heat dome over East Antarctica, and especially over the Lake Vostok or the Vostok region, where temperatures were 70 degrees above normal. So, I mean, could that be related in any way to the ice cube detector? Could it be related to something at the bottom of Vostok, next to the Lake Vostok, that is activating? Or do you have any kind of reaction to that?
Absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong. It could be a manipulation, but it's also something that happens every day, all over the continent. There is so much scientists on the ice that get really, really bored in the wintertime. There's not a lot to do to preoccupy people. There's a lot of stats being taken. So when somebody says that we broke a record today on April 2nd, it's never been this hot on an April 2nd, right here at this spot that we're testing. It's been 70. They're kind of like cherry picking stats. Like, they're really hard, specific stats. Like, this happened all the time at South Pole. They'll say, you know, oh, guess what? Today is March 10th and it's minus 50 degrees. And it's only been minus 10 degrees typically. So this is the coldest it's ever been on this day ever. That happens too. But does that make the news? You know, and then same thing with when we get back to the heat thing, it's actually really common. So any time a storm blows in, let's say you're at South Pole Station proper and it's winter time. Okay. If there's no storm, you're at the coldest place on the Earth. If a storm comes in, it's coming in from somewhere else. So it's bringing in warmth. Everywhere else is warmer. So it is actually really common that all of a sudden a storm blows in. And out of nowhere, just because you had a storm on that day that never had a storm in the history of that facility, now you get a storm on that day, first one ever. But guess what? Now you're getting a 70 degree warmer day because you just so happened to have 40 mile an hour winds on that day when you never had that before. But they don't discuss in the news the 40 mile an hour wind. They don't discuss that there was just a storm. They like to leave the question mark at the end. When they literally already had the answer. They knew exactly what caused the temperature rise. They just omit that from the story because it's now sensational. It's not just a boring story about a storm at the South Pole.
Okay, so just kind of like to go the full circle now. I mean, earlier on we talked about when you were in the Navy, you were taken to this Raytheon facility and introduced to some classified program. We're talking now, 20 years later or something like that. You're now working
very close to it,
working for Raytheon at the South Pole. So is there some connection?
I can't imagine there isn't, sir. I feel like that I've been involved with programs there's an old song, from the womb to the tomb. So I feel like there's something happening there. that I've learned about these programs that the Germans were doing that actually start in the womb. So I believe that something happened there. I was involved with something. I believe that the United States Navy, who was trying to put me in charge of potentially nuclear-tipped weapons. So I think when the military teaches someone to shoot a rifle, they know that that person is still not really interested in killing people. It's not human nature to want to kill people. So they know that when the troops go to the field, it's going to take a while for them to actually fire at the enemy and try to kill someone. So I think there was a similar understanding in the Navy when it came to the rate that I was volunteering for, the potential damage that I can do and the conscience that I would have or not have. I don't think they were waiting for me to turn 18 years old to volunteer for that job, to start training me for a role that would give me that level of responsibility in a very short period of time. I think the training started much earlier in life. Mm-hmm. But I was tapped, selected, guided, whatever you want to call it. It's a process that I'm trying to figure out myself, but I feel that a lot of my life has been part of a process of other people's intentions.
So the follow-up question there is, okay, so you spend a year in Antarctica in 2010 at the South Pole with the same company that may have been associated with you doing some secret space program service back in the, 1990s or 1994.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so do you think something happened in Antarctica that you may not consciously remember in that 1 year that you spent there? Because you obviously have good memory recall, mm-hmm. of, you know, working on maintenance of the ice cube facility and doing other things around the base. But could you have been doing other stuff there that right now you don't have conscious memory of?
I think 1,000%. I see where you're going with that. I agree. I think part of the programs as a child in manufacturing these dissociative portions are mental compartments, mm-hmm. and memories can be fragmented. And I believe that cues and things could occur, that there's a high probability that we were staged labor, made ready and available at a place that would come and grab us and come and go as needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my thought.
Yeah, I mean, for real. And you're not the first person to suggest it. I mean, this is John Warner IV contacted me after seeing my stuff and kind of came at me from the same angle and was like, hey, man, do you realize what probably happened to you? And I was like, I didn't really kind of think of it that way. But he was like, yeah, you need to, you know, do some more digging.
Yeah, I think that's a good advice. Well, just to finish up then, is there anything you want to say to my audience? Any kind of giveaway, anything you want to share about yourself, about if people want to contact you or learn more about you?
I would just say, I guess, first and foremost, let's not let the factions that be divide us. We, the people, can fix all of the problems that have been presented to us. The world is about to get a lot crazier than we could ever have imagined. Hold on to your hats. It's going to get nuts. But as far as following me, if you could please go to deciphering.tv, I would really appreciate it. I need to get this information shared far and wide. I do think it's very important. These are the facts of the matter that support the testimonies of all the people that you've been following to this point. I just want to be here to help push them along their way with their travels, to get their testimonies out as well, and let people know this stuff is real. There is stuff going on this planet that shows the SSP is real. It's out there. We are off this planet functionally. The cosmos is wild, and we need to be more aware and involved.
Well, I want to thank you, Eric, for coming on the show and sharing your incredible information with everyone.
Thank you so much, sir.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.